So nice to have you back, Mark.
Thanks for having me. It's an honor and a pleasure to be on Dialogue Works.
Let's get started with what's going on between Russia and NATO. Recently, we had a meeting between Joe Biden and Starmer. There are a lot of discussions around this meeting, and it seems that the United States, at the end of the day, they're thinking of some sort of de-escalation. How do you find it right now? Are we heading toward de-escalation of some sort of off-ramp, or NATO is still capable of escalating the conflict?
No, definitely not heading towards any kind of de-escalation or off-ramp. There is a temporary pause, I would say, on the specifics of escalation with regards to long-range NATO conducting long-range strikes into Russia. And that's what it is. Let's be honest about this. Let's look past the fig leaf implausible deniability of a Kiev regime proxy and understand what these strikes are. Because President Putin, in an interview with journalists, laid it quite clearly out, right? That, first of all, these are obviously advanced NATO weapons. They are provided by NATO. They have to use American, specifically American satellite data to be guided to target. They have to have the firing sequence, the targeting information, inputted by NATO military specialists. This is not something that can be done or would allowed to be done by Kiev regime because of the top secret proprietary nature of the coding and stuff for these weapons. So Putin was quite clear. This would be in every way a NATO attack on Russia, deep in Russia. I mean, technically, NATO's already been attacking Russia with these things for quite some time. They've been attacking them in Crimea. They've been attacking them in the Donbass. They've been attacking them in Kherson and Zaporozhye. They've been attacking them even in the Kharkov region and the Belgorod region across from it. But Putin's basically said, okay, so perhaps I've let you walk all over me too much as it is. Enough is enough. If you do this, we will respond. And Putin had laid that out earlier, right? One, they reserve the right to strike the US and the UK directly, right? But he also put out there that they could choose to basically do the quid pro quo. We will find a U.S. adversary. We will hand over and help them fire these weapons. And then you have 800 to 1,000 military bases, just the U.S., right? Another few hundred for the United Kingdom and France around the world. You have lots of military assets that are vulnerable. We will, you know, make sure it happens. And then the last time this reared its head, which was about 6 weeks ago, if you remember, wasn't so long, CNN put out a report that Russia had been about to transfer long-range advanced anti-ship missiles to the Houthis, to the Ahrar al-Salah movement in Yemen. And you know the Houthis, they're the only ones in the world who want to go to war with the United States. They're chomping at the bit. They're like, give me the missiles. I'll fire the missiles for you. I will hit them, right? They've been attacking U.S. warships in the Red Sea, right? The U.S. Has tried hitting them with airstrikes and cruise missiles, but the Houthis have been avoiding Saudi, which is essentially saying U.S. airstrikes, you know, for most of a decade at this point, right? They can take their hits. It's whack-a-mole, right? You know, in the desert. And this is the poorest country in the world. And they have already successfully driven a U.S. carrier out of the Red Sea. They tucked tail and got out rather than risk it because it wasn't worth it. And Western shipping through the Red Sea as a result of that has been, you know, ground to a halt. And added all kinds of expenses for, you know, going around the Cape of Good Hope and everything, but not for the rest of the world, not for Russia, not for China, you know, not for the global South, not even for Saudi Arabia. The Houthis have given passage to Saudi Arabia. They say, well, you know, we have our differences, right? But you're not assisting Israel. So that, there we go. You know, you're free to pass through, which is just hilarious. You know, that is all before they're handed weapons. The same report says that Russia is already providing them satellite and targeting information. Maybe. We have no way of knowing, right? It could be true. It could not. There's been lots of things that the Western media have put out about Russia. But at that point, 6 weeks ago, evidently the US, the UK, and Saudi Arabia talked to the Russians and talked them down. And we have to assume that talking them out of it included, all right, so we won't launch long-range strikes. We won't hit you with missiles deep in Russia. And that was how it was for about 5 weeks until the next time the pressure, I would say, you know, yeah, from the Kiev regime, begging, whining, pleading, screaming, but even more the media. The media seems to drive this thing as the ultimate warmongers, right? Always crying for escalation, hounding U.S. government officials. If you listen to the U.S., you know, the White House and the State Department and the Pentagon press corps, why won't you give these weapons to Ukraine? You know, why won't you? Why won't you? It's always they say they need it to survive. Why won't you do it? It's always the media that has been driving this escalation cycle to a significant degree, not 100%, of course. But the United Kingdom is also really, the tail wagging the dog in this situation. And there is indication that at prior times in the conflict, they have done as much as well. If you'll remember, the United Kingdom is the first of the NATO countries to send tanks to Ukraine. They promised the Challengers first. The Challengers were actually the last one tanks to be used in combat by the Kiev regime, not to any effect either. But it was, the British that basically shamed, you know, in the Western view of things, the United States and Germany into sending their tanks. And then the U.S. said, well, Germany, you send the Leopards first, and then we'll agree to send a few Abrams much later. And now we know that most of those Abrams were destroyed. That just goes to show that the United Kingdom has many times been the hottest. And once again, it has in this most recent push to give the Kiev regime long-range strikes in Russia. And let's be specific what we're talking about here. For the United Kingdom, it is the Storm Shadows and the French Scout missiles, right? The French are being really quiet right now because Macron is in a really bad political situation. Previously, he was also driving things, but if they're doing so now, it's quietly. It's behind the curtain. The UK is taking the floor, and the US in question would be the long-range ATACMS missiles fired from the HIMARS systems, and possibly there has been a lot of word about the transfer of JASSMs, which is a U.S. air-launched cruise missile that would also fall into this category. We don't know that they have been transferred yet, but if they did give this permission, the understanding is that there are a very finite number of ATACMS available, right? The ATACMS production stopped in the mid-2000s, right? The U.S. thought it had its sufficient inventory. They had a long-range strike replacement. That is still, they're still, quote-unquote, ironing out the kinks, right? There's still problems with it. So they haven't gotten that online. And the Pentagon said, anonymously through an anonymous Pentagon official to CNN that the Kiev regime should expect no more large supplies of ATACMS missiles, right? They've been given something like 200 already. And according to CNN, they've already burned through most of those. They don't have many left. So if the Pentagon's not willing to give up any more ATACMS, and the Pentagon has a supply of ATACMS, right? But they don't want to use them all because they want to keep enough of a minimum inventory for war with China, which you know, is this Thucydides trap inevitability that they believe in. They believe China's a greater priority. They're very worried about what the Pentagon continually whines about as a missile gap. They want to put land-based cruise missiles in the southern Japanese islands and Guam, you know, all over the place, and you know they're busy planning for that. But the long and the short is they don't want. They've already given more attack than they want to. Biden or Biden's handlers had to pry them out of the Pentagon's hands, and now the Pentagon has evidently drawn a line. So no more. So that is why they would have to transfer the JASSMs. The U.S. has considerably more JASSMs in storage. The problem with the JASSMs, of course, is that they have to be air launched. And the Kiev regime is having has single digits of other type of Soviet legacy aircraft left. And the F-16s, obviously, they've had some growing pains with the F-16s. They've lost at least one. Depending on the story, it just crashed after successfully shooting down a billion Russian missiles and drones, or a Patriot accidentally shot it down, somehow the identify friend or foe not working, or Russia hit it on the airfield with an Iskander missile after a propaganda video revealed it gave a quick glimpse behind the one guy's shoulder that allowed it to be geolocated to an airfield outside Ivano-Frankivsk, and Russia took the pilot and the aircraft out there. Now, and that it was its first flight as an air defense role, right? You know, not even a combat role per se. So if the JASSMs had to be fired from the F-16s, that's not exactly a showcase capability. And Lloyd Austin also gave other reasons why the long range strikes wasn't worth the trouble. He pointed out that supposedly one of the hot targets that the Kiev regime wants to hit is airfields, specifically the airfields that, for instance, the glide bombs are being launched out of, because these glide bombs are the FABs and the CABs are just absolutely devastating Kiev regime fortifications. And it has been, that has been a real game changer in this conflict, the FABs. But Lloyd Austin said that 90% of the aircraft that Russia is using in the SMO are already based for their operations outside of the ATACMS range. So it wouldn't be anything that there is sufficient targets even to affect the status on the battle. And the Pentagon has said that repeatedly now. It wouldn't change anything. It's not a significant enough capability. What they're also saying is we don't want to also face the repercussions of being hit by Russian missiles, or having Russian missiles in the hands of the Houthis or Kataib Hezbollah or who knows who else Russia would transfer the missiles out of. Supposedly, the U.S. has tried to restart ATACMS production, but there's no word whether they have even managed that. And if they were, it would be very low numbers. So obviously, the Pentagon doesn't want to give up any more ATACMS. And then, of course, there's the fact that Russian electronic warfare and air defense has already kind of mooted it. to be perfectly honest. This is why Russia is probably not militarily worried about this, because Russia, like every other GPS guided system that the U.S. has provided to the Kiev regime, be it the Excaliburs, the ground launched small diameter bombs, everything they've given, Russian electronic warfare very quickly develops a profile for this, and then they're just, you know, useless hunks of metal floating through space, unable to find their targets. And this was even highlighted in an article, I believe, in the Wall Street Journal, talking about advanced U.S. weapons work in Ukraine up until they don't. And then, which is, it's the classic scene from Star Trek, where the Federation, every time they encounter the Borg, they get three shots with a phaser before the Borg shields adapt, and then that's it. And the phasers are absolutely useless, and you might as well chuck the phaser at them, right? I mean, that's the story here. And also Russia's air defense. And everyone grudgingly acknowledges that Russia has the best air defense system in the world. So a combination of the electronic warfare and the air defense, it's why you don't hear much about attack-ims. It's why you don't hear much about Storm Shadows or Scalps. You heard about them for about a month, and then they just kind of disappeared. And every once in a while, they'll get a hit, they'll sneak one through, or they'll happen to pick a target that is not protected by electronic warfare and air defense. And let's be honest, Russia is a, you know, in the terms of a certain U.S. president, a ginormous country, right? Russia can't protect everything in Russia with electronic warfare and air defense, but they've got enough of it to protect most of what's of real value. That's why you heard about 2 months ago, ooh, we used attack-ims to destroy a train ferry. Whoa, you really socked it to that train ferry. You know, soft of soft target. Pick a target where there's no air defense and electronic warfare. Yeah, then you can probably hit something. But otherwise, I would say that Russia probably has, wherever it has defenses, it has about a 60 to 70% chance of taking even the attack-ems down, and probably slightly higher with the Storm Shadows and the Scalp. And it would be the same thing with the JASSMs. So Russia is not so necessarily concerned that these long-range strikes would be some devastating battlefield effect. They would take their hits, but it wouldn't change the course of the war. But of course, it's the precedent. You can't allow NATO to be firing weapons deep into Russia, right? And you never know what, of course, you know, you always have to fear, you know, what is that weapon actually tipped with? Have they managed to tip that weapon with a tactical nuclear warhead? You know, is that something they've developed the capability to do? Do we know what type of warhead that missile is carrying? No. So you can't, no one that can prevent these things will allow these things. That's why Russia has drawn a line here. And so far it's held in that regard. However, I want to bring out two attacks in the last week that a lot of Russian analysts are talking about. One of them was a Kiev regime, quote unquote, drone attack in Murmansk. All right. So picture Russia, you know, picture the Ukrainian border. And in the very northwest corner of Russia, right up here, up against Finland, the Kola Peninsula, in the Arctic Circle, is Murmansk. How on earth did the Kiev regime manage to get drones through Russia, possibly Belarusian airspace, through that entire length and managed to hit something in Murmansk? Well, they didn't actually hit anything. Supposedly there was an attack, I believe something like three drones, and they were shot down as they tried to attack an airfield. But most Russian military analysts believe that these drones were launched out of Finland. Okay. The second attack occurred just in the last couple of days and was much more effective. It hit a weapons depot in Tver, right? Northwest of Moscow. Now, that is some 300 kilometers from the nearest possible Kiev regime held territory. Not impossible, but very difficult to believe that they would have transited that far. And there was one SBU source that said that there was hundreds, 100 drones involved in that attack. Now, I don't know if that's true or not. The official Russian Ministry of Defense is there was a drone and it was shot down and the debris fell and started a fire. And that was it. And the Russian Ministry of Defense has done their version of lying, which is usually done by omission. They just don't talk about it. Okay. We've seen the pictures. It was an explosion and resulting secondary explosions that, you know, looked like a mushroom cloud. It wasn't a mushroom cloud, you know, but it was a very significant conventional blast. And these are old. This was an old Soviet weapons depot that recently received an upgrade under Bulgakov, who is the former deputy defense minister. Supposedly, the upgrade happened in 2018, and the improvement, the addition, provided new super underground concrete bunkers, steel hardened, that supposedly can resist a nuclear blast, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so that deputy defense minister, Bulgakov, is also, by the way, being charged with corruption. So just fraud and corruption. So just saying that those storage facilities may or may not be all they're whacked up to be. There's various accounts of what was actually hit on this weapons depot. What was stored there? Did the hit just occur over the Soviet legacy part and the newer parts are largely unscathed? You know, was it just grad ammunition and small arms, or were there Iskanders and Iranian and North Korean ballistic missiles, according to some of the wilder Kiev regime accounts? We don't know. There was a very big explosion and several secondary explosions, which registered on the seismic scale, right? So they hit something. They successfully got one through. And there's questions about it. And again, most Russian military analysts seem to think that the attacks came on Tver, on this weapons depot, from the Baltics. So the Russian Ministry of Defense has been very, very quiet about both of those attacks, right? Which is why we know very little. What we've gotten has been from Russian, you know, war bloggers, Telegram channels, and the Ukrainian version of events, and that's it. So there is the possibility that attacks were launched from NATO against Russia twice in just over a week. Now, that, of course, is significant. There are two possibilities there. One, NATO allowed it to happen. Two, the Kiev regime launched drones out of these countries. You know, SBU, perhaps the Ukrainian military intelligence, you know, Budanov's boys, Kirilo, I like the dark Budanov. That sounds like something right up his alley. It would not be impossible for him to sneak a drone into these countries and launch it with the intention of Russia overreacting, right? And striking back against NATO, or you know, at least creating a pattern that might lead to a Russian escalatory step against NATO. Now, the Ukrainian media outlet, the Telegram channel Resident, just in the last 24 hours, put out a claim that supposedly Yermak is Zelensky's chief of staff. He's regarded as the gray cardinal, the Cardinal Richelieu. Some people in Ukraine argue that he's the one really running the country. In fact, it has led to a common Ukrainian combining of the two names into Zermak to refer to Zelensky and Yermak in control of the country. But supposedly Yermak has settled on that Ukraine's only chance now is an escalation that would bring NATO directly into the conflict, right? Which, all right, I've been talking about since, spring of 2022 as an inevitability at some point, right? There's every possibility to believe that they could be trying to drag NATO in, whether NATO is willing or not. So that, I believe, is why the Russian Ministry of Defense is so quiet about these attacks, is because they're trying to figure out exactly what happened so that they don't jump to conclusions. I do not believe that there is the appetite at the moment for direct NATO intervention, right? To send troops into Ukraine. The U.S. is obviously in a political crisis state with the elections and the possibility that Trump will and J.D. Vance will be elected. And who knows what will happen when he's elected. Maybe he'll go back and rehire, John Bolton and Pompeo, and nothing will change whatsoever. On the other hand, he's right. We've got his surrogate, RFK Jr., with Trump Jr. writing articles in The Hill that call for an end to the conflict on Russian terms, of the Istanbul communique. Obviously, Russia's terms have gotten harder since then. But, I actually believe right now that Russia probably does not want Trump elected, because they don't want peace. They do not want to be pressured into peace at this point. And if Trump came up with even a half credible plan, Russia would be facing pressure from BRICS allies like Brazil and India to really engage with it. And Russia is winning, right? There's a lot of people, not everyone in the Kremlin, but there's a lot of people in the Kremlin that are saying, regime change. That's it. We're going all the way. We'll go to Kiev or to the Polish border if we have to. And I'm one of those people, that you should want to call them hawks, that believe that that is the only way for this to be settled. That if it isn't, it is just something that will rear its head again in a few years. This regime, this ideologically anti-Russian Banderite regime, cannot be allowed to exist in Ukraine. Whatever the cost, guerrilla war in West Ukraine, I did not want that at the beginning of this conflict, but at this point, it's clear that NATO will never stop. It's better to fight a guerrilla war than it is to have some type of rump Ukraine turned into a constant NATO, de facto NATO weapons platform against Russia. An entire generation of Ukrainian children, the next generation raised to be anti-Russian warrior cased for NATO. No, that it cannot be allowed. So I believe at this point that Russia does not want peace, was probably very relieved by this Kursk Fool's Crusade, because it took the pressure even from its own allies, not from China probably, but supposedly from Brazil and India, to engage in serious diplomatic negotiations. And I believe that Russia's is, or the Kremlin should be, well past that at this point. Who do they sign something with? Trump? And what happens in four more years when Trump is gone, right? And it's I don't think that a diplomatic settlement to this conflict can happen or will happen. And if it does happen, it will probably be a disaster, just like Minsk, you know. And how many times can, you know, if you want a picture, the Kiev regime is Lucy and Putin as Charlie Brown, and pulling that football out at the last minute again and again and again. No, I'll let you kick it this time. You know, that's the situation. And I know Putin's first instinct is a diplomatic settlement, you know, is negotiations. But there's certainly Medvedev, who is playing the new Zhirinovsky in the Russian government since Zhirinovsky passed away. He's now become the war hawk, blowhard, if you will. I don't particularly like Medvedev because I still remember him as a neoliberal who was awkwardly dancing to American Boy, the song. I will never trust him. But I have to admit that everything he's been saying in the last 2 years, I fully agree with. So, except when he talks about nukes. That's just not helpful. Just shut up about the nukes. Russia has enough conventional power. You don't need to talk about nukes. You're not going to use nukes. The West knows you're not going to use nukes. So just shut up about the nukes. It's not helpful. But the point is that while the West is not at the moment ready for direct intervention, the political crisis in the U.S., the political crisis in France with Macron facing an impeachment, that's probably almost certainly not going to happen. But anyway, there's a political crisis in France. The German government is so fragile and weak at this point that, you know, it's only hanging together by impetus. And that leaves Keir Starmer driving things. And he just doesn't have the power at this point. Supposedly, he went to ask permission from the U.S. to use the Storm Shadows and Scalps. Those words specifically were used, at least I believe in a Guardian report on it, which is really humiliating, but for the United Kingdom, once a historically a superpower of its own accord, but that's where they are now. So for all these reasons, there isn't the appetite at the moment, but this is still very early days. And I believe that at some level, the West is ready to accept, maybe not a settlement, but to accept a frozen conflict along the Donbass lines, right? They know Donbass is lost, right? That's why they've never been hot on holding or recovering the Donbass. They know the Donbass is lost, even if they won't admit it. But what happens after the Donbass, right? Russia is, you know, going to be mopping up Pokrovsk and South Donbass in the next 3 months here. By the winter, by the new year, they will probably be starting the move on the Kiev regime's last defensive line at the Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, Konstantinovka line. So if the Russian pressure holds, if the Kiev regime continues to be able to slow Russian forces down but not stop them, then by next summer, by this time next year, all of Donbass should be liberated. And there is the potential that Russia could open up another front in Zaporozhye or somewhere else. Then what? According to the Russian constitution, of course, Donbass is not enough. Russia, according to the Russian constitution, due to the referendums that were held there, Kherson and Zaporozhye are part of Russia. And obviously, Kherson city has to be recovered. And Zaporozhye city, which Russia has never taken yet in this conflict, has to be taken. So even if you get the four republics, that still leaves the forcing NATO and the Kiev regime to give up on NATO, which is the principal reason for going in, and almost certainly the battle will bring swaths of territory potentially in the Dnieper region by that point, because past Pokrovsk, there's nothing all the way. No, it's open steppe, no geographical barriers, no big settlements all the way to the Dnieper River. So almost certainly Russia will move into that operational space and be moving towards the Dnieper to some degree by then. And of course, Kharkov region and other areas. So I think that there is a considerable portion of the Russian population that will not consider this special military operation a success unless at least all of East Ukraine and South Ukraine, including Odessa, are recovered at this point, right? I think the Russian people would accept a Dnieper, you know, division of Ukraine, and, you know, like along the North Korea, South Korea lines. I'm not so sure that I still, that doesn't get away the core problems of a de facto NATO, then Ukrainian rump state, but at least it adds some more strategic depth to the situation and saves, you know, the majority of the Russian speaking population of Ukraine. But that's a long way off. That's a long way off. I know a lot of people keep expecting that, you know, in just 2 months, the Kiev regime military is going to collapse. That's it. They're just not going to be able to fight anymore. They're just going to collapse and it's all going to be over and peace treaties are going to be signed. They're going to surrender. And I wish, I mean, I hope, I don't believe that that's the way this is going to happen. I believe there's still a long, hard, bloody slog ahead. Obviously Western support is going to decrease on one level because there is a rising political opposition, you know, to the amounts of financial aid required to keep the Kiev regime afloat. Germany has announced, for instance, that they're going to cut financial aid by half. And the U.S., the Biden admin backed off a plan to ask Congress for more money this year. But more important than that, they've simply, the Pentagon is still sitting on $6 billion from the last allowance from Congress, and they don't know how to spend it because they're not making enough of what the Kiev regime needs for this conflict, right? Artillery shells, air defense interceptor missiles, air defense systems, right? These things are not something that the West, in particular the U.S., but also the rest of NATO, is producing in enough numbers. And if you take a look at, you know, a lot of the recent, particularly the U.S. packages, these are not presidential drawdown authority. These are not being taken from U.S. stock and handed to the Kiev regime. These are orders for things yet to be produced, given to the U.S. military industrial complex. They are not appearing in the Kiev regime's hands next month. And that's because the U.S. military industrial complex is not geared up for this type of war, and they can't ramp it up fast enough. They're not on a war economy. Russia isn't on a complete war economy either, but Russia had plenty of surge capacity for this type of production. Left over from the Soviet Union and kept it updated, and it was, you know, ready to be put on, because Russia's been preparing for this war since 1946, at least, right? They never stopped being prepared for this war. They always knew that this war was going to happen in one way, shape, or form. So, but they will still provide something, right? They can provide Bradleys until the apocalypse, probably, right? They've got enough of you know, infantry fighting vehicles, APCs, you know, this type of mechanized warfare that we've learned to expect from the Kiev regime. Drone production. China has finally put on some export controls on drones. But of course, that's just going to be gone around. It's going to be ordered by third countries, you know, on the Ukraine's behalf, and maybe raise the costs for them, make it a little bit more difficult. That said, Putin, you know, revealed this week that Russia's making what 100 and is making 4,000 drones a day now. That's mad. We're in a completely different world. And they plan to be able to increase production by 10 times. I don't even know what that seems. Is that from the initial number? Is that from the number now? That wasn't entirely clear to me. But regardless, we know that Russia has a huge drone advantage already, and that's only increasing, right? As well as an artillery advantage and the air superiority and the electronic warfare advantage. And that said, it's still a hard fight. Right. The Kiev regime is not done yet. They launched this Kursk incursion. And yes, it's going very badly for them now. Russia just essentially said, all right, you took these podunk hamlets. Now what? You didn't get the Kursk nuclear power plant. You were never going to. And now you're trapped. And Russia was perfectly happy. It's only in the last, 10 days that they've started, 2 weeks, 10 days that they've started a Kursk counteroffensive. For all six, seven weeks before that, they were content to let the Kursk incursion sit there, keep it contained, and use it as a fire bag. And they destroyed enormous amounts of Western equipment. Manpower, too, but primarily Western equipment. They just destroyed. I think they got at least 7 HIMARS systems and several M270s too. They got multiple air defense systems in the initial phases. They used it as a fire bag. And only when the Kiev regime has really no vehicles left, they're using civilian vehicles getting around now in the Kursk region because they don't have enough vehicles left for the troops. And they started to transfer some manpower back to the Pokrovsk area, right? Because they're now the media, I swear to God, they only respond to the Western media, right? If their own generals tell them this is a bad idea and Pokrovsk will fall faster than before, they don't listen. But if the Western media starts talking about it, suddenly Zelensky's worried enough about it to do something. So the Western media started talking about Pokrovsk, and suddenly he's sending troops from Kursk back to Pokrovsk. And at that point, the Russian government evidently figured, all right, let's wrap this up, and started the counteroffensive. They got what they wanted from it. And we've heard varying numbers, but regardless, the Kiev regime suffered enormous equipment damage. And it makes perfect sense. Forbes, David Axe, very pro-Kiev regime writer, wrote a piece talking that, according to, some bullshit analysis, Oryx and whatnot, but regardless, that the Kiev regime had suffered, was at least going through Western-provided equipment twice as fast being destroyed as it was on the Eastern Front in the Donbas. And that makes perfect sense. In the Donbas, they've got fortifications. They've got territory that's their own they held with decent logistics, with fortifications, with trenches and, urban areas, sufficient with high-rise buildings and factories and whatnot to hide these vehicles in. In these podunk hamlets, right, in sparsely populated forest Kursk region, there's none of that. There's no fortifications. There's no high-rise buildings. There's no factories. There's nothing for them to hide in. All of that stuff is out in the open, and it was destroyed. So they had their initial tactical success. They penetrated a barely defended border to begin with. They won their information war for about 3 or 4 weeks. The Western media was cheerleading. Everyone was happy. And then, we were saying right at the beginning, be happy, enjoy it now, because it's not going to last. And sure enough, that's where we are now. And just this week, Politico has put out a knife in the back of Zelensky, talking to Ukrainian commanders who said that they tried, generals actually tried to warn Zelensky not to do this, and he just removed them, right? So that the blame game has begun over Kursk, and it's not completely wrapped up. That said, they're still fighting in Kursk, right? They might be facing cauldrons or mini cauldrons, but they're not all fleeing. Right. They locally, yes, they'll a certain number of surrender or break. But by and large, you know, they're still fighting. They just this week they launched a crazy new offensive in the Kursk region to the west of the existing incursion in what we talked about prior. This is the Glushovsky district of the Kursk region. And the Kiev, we knew, we talked about before that the Kiev regime also had a buildup of forces there, and there was the potential for a second incursion. And the particulars of the Glushovsky region is that there is a small section with the Syme River running east-west or west-east across most of a section of it there, which kind of created a perfect situation for moving in, destroying the bridges across that river to prevent reinforcement, and very quickly seizing that chunk of the idea was partially isolated territory, and then coming up again towards the Kursk nuclear power plant, probably from a slightly different angle, from a different direction. Well, they didn't do it for the longest time, and Russia has been putting up pontoon bridges faster than the Kiev regime can destroy them. They kept reinforcements. They expanded their area with the counteroffensive to provide a good supply, and the Kiev regime has been trying to break past the border in the Glushovsky districts at Vesulia and Glushovka for a week now, and there's a lot of fog of war, but it seems pretty clear from that both sides agree that the Kiev regime hasn't gotten anywhere with it. But said, they're still trying, right? They're still attacking. They're not at the point of collapse, and they are definitely feeling the attrition, right? The attrition is showing, and it's going to continue to show. But I don't see anywhere in the near to medium future where the Kiev regime military just says, "Oh, that's it. We can't fight anymore. We give up." You know that, or they just collapse and the whole front collapses. I don't think it's going to happen that way. I think it's going to continue to be a gradual erosion. A gradual erosion of fighting capability, of defense capability. They're still trying to defend everything, right? Eventually, they will be forced to give certain things up and only defend. But they can still concentrate enough forces to really slow Russia down. How long has Russia been fighting in the Kursk region, right? At Lipsy and Volchansk? Right, the fight for Chasiv Yar. Okay, so Russia made some significant advances inside the central Chasiv Yar in the last week. That said, that fight has still gone on for a long time. In the Pokrovsk area, they haven't been able to stop Russian forces. They've barely been able to slow them down. But they're going to try to make a big fight for Pokrovsk. It will not be a Bakhmut. It's just not the terrain. They don't have a surrounding urban agglomerations and so forth to help them. And they're much more deteriorated at this point. But the flow of Western arms will not just cease. It won't be enough for them to win, but it will be enough for them to continue a fighting defense for a year. Perhaps more. And for all the hopes, you know, yes, they're obviously suffering huge manpower problems. Thus, the franticness of the press gangs and trying to figure out ways to force Ukrainian refugees in Europe to get them to force them to come back or whatever. But the Kiev regime can still, they still haven't conscripted anyone below the age of 25. Everyone from 18 to 25. And even when you take a look at that population and figure out how many of it is female, how many has already fled to Europe, and so forth, most of the number crunching I've seen still says there's about 100,000 that the Kiev regime can effectively draw on just of the male population in each of those years, right? 25, 24. And by the time you start going down the years, you know, two or three, you've already got all, an entire new cadre of people who have turned 18 and so forth, right? They can continue conscripting people for some time yet. And if they run out of young men, there's always women. And that has been brought up in the Rada before and before. And there's no sign that any type of political dissent or activity in Ukraine can overthrow the government or have any effect like that. All the opposition, political opposition to the Maidan regime has long since been banned and purged and either driven out of the country or killed, right? There's, if a man dares go out and protest, right, he just immediately becomes cannon fodder. He's immediately sent to the press gang, right? So they can continue this. They will destroy. They are already destroying Ukraine's future because of particularly of the demographic narrowing where the Kiev regime, just why they haven't conscripted anyone below 25 now is because they have, in relative terms, such a small demographic at that age group. Because basically after the 1990s or during the 1990s, you know, when the economic bad times began, Ukraine just stopped having kids, right? And that's something that has continued up to this day. That's why they've been conscripting late 40s, 50s, 60-year-olds, because they got a lot more of them to spare, right? That's why they've been doing the fighting. And ever since, they've had less and less children, and that's resulted in the demographic narrowing. So out of some sense of preservation of a future Ukrainian nation, they have refrained from forcibly conscripting 18 to 25 year olds. They've been happy to take people who have volunteered, and there's been enough of them, but they still have that pool to draw on. And I absolutely believe that this Zelensky / Banderite regime will gladly burn through Ukraine's future in this fight as well. So they're going to be suffering perhaps more pressure from facing a winter with just a few hours of electricity and warmth. Things will get very hard. There'll be a new flood of refugees in Europe. But I think that at the point where the Kiev regime is facing a de facto a real military collapse, where they're just not able, where the Russian military keeps growing stronger, where they're still fighting, but they can't effectively defend much anymore. When Russia starts moving on Kharkov, moving past the Dnieper in the direction of Kiev or Odessa, that is when there's going to be a resurgent push for NATO to get directly involved. And by then, that will be a year and a half, perhaps 2 years down the road. And the political climate may look very different. We don't know what it will look like. And that they will push very hard for direct NATO intervention. There was just a, Russian hoaxsters that impersonate people. They just had a conversation with a top Polish leader this week.
Sikorsky,
yes. And they got him to talk about, well, we're not going to send troops in now, but if the Kiev regime military looks like it's about to collapse, that's a different story, right? Then they'll be willing to, right? So they will absolutely get as close to the last Ukrainian first as they can. But after that, there will be a renewed push for direct intervention, almost absolutely. And I believe eventually it's going to come. Russia has known, I think, since the beginning of this conflict that it's going to come. They've tried to limit escalation. They've tried to show restraint. And NATO just keeps perceiving it as weakness again and again and again. And they've gone up and up and up and up the escalation ladder. And right now they've hit a pause with this long range strikes. But if you believe that that's the end and they're just going to say, oh, we give up, Russia wins, I've got a bridge in Crimea I'd like to sell you. Everything, almost everything on the battlefield is positive. Right, they'll get their hits like this weapons depot in Tver. There will be increasing acts of desperation and dirty tricks. I expect, you know, before any direct NATO intervention, absolutely there will be a false flag event. Putin will suddenly decide to start using chemical weapons, or they'll destroy a nuclear power plant, or you know something, because that's the way the U.S. always, you know, provides motivation and justifications for its wars. And while there's no political sediment then, just wait until Putin starts using chemical weapons. Let's just wait till the press gets a hold of something like that, you know, or something similar. There absolutely will be a false flag. There will be lots more dirty tricks, right? We all know that they were really trying to get to the Kursk nuclear power plant. And they weren't able to, but there will be more dirty tricks, right? They will come up with things. Because they'll have the help of NATO minds coming up with dirty tricks as well. And they're, you know, for everything, they're pretty inventive at shall we, the Kiev regime's forces are pretty inventive at, shall we say, unconventional warfare. Right, unconventional approaches, thinking of new ways to kill and maim and terrorize. Give them credit; they can be pretty inventive. This latest dragon drone that shoots out several thousand degree thermite. Okay, so it turns out that it's not actually some game changing weapon. That it's pretty slow. That it's incredibly vulnerable to air defense and electronic warfare. And generally speaking, Russian troops have plenty of time to move out of its way. However, it can pretty much really wreck any fortifications and tree lines and stuff like that. So it has some utility. Looks really good. Newsweek was all excited about it, right? You know, but, you know, the idea is they're still working on things like this. By the way, one of the things that we've seen a little bit of a change on in the military technology being used is in the Kursk region, Russia, for the first time in this conflict, has felt confident and comfortable enough that there's no Kiev regime air defense left in that area that they started using long-range strike drones. Not kamikaze drones, not loitering munitions, you know, not FPVs, nothing, but actual strike drones, including the Orion, but others. Now, if you'll remember, there was a lot of talk about, you know, Bayraktars at the beginning of this conflict and everything, and then they all got wiped really quick. And very grudgingly, there came to be the acknowledgement that these strike drones are pretty crap in any environment with air defense, that they don't do well in those environments. But in the Kursk region, the Kiev regime has no air defense left. So they've been experimenting with strike drones, reportedly even using strike drones to fire glide bombs, which is will be a useful addition. They don't even have to put their more expensive aircraft if they can work that out effectively. But that's a new change that is you know, more significant on the battlefield than dragon drones. The fight continues, and while locally, you know, we're seeing some surrenders, some troops, the Kyiv regime is definitely facing an operational crisis in South Central Donbass, right? The Pokrovsk and the Ugledar offensives are now effectively almost merging at this point. Ugledar's days are numbered. They're just going to be cut off, and they'll have no, if the Kyiv regime leaves those troops there to surrender or die, that's just what's going to happen. The supply lines to Ugledar are being cut. So that Ugledar has been a bone in Russia's throat. They tried to storm that. It's effectively a plateau, a town consisting almost entirely of high-rise buildings, you know, apartment buildings type, arranged in a tight grid fashion on top of this plateau with nothing for miles around, just flat. And so that makes the attacking force extremely vulnerable. And Russia tried to take Ugledar 4 or 5 times earlier in this conflict with some really stupid, straightforward charges that just really got them, you know, onto minefields and other things. They got them killed. But now Russian forces are moving in from all areas, right? They're cutting off the supply lines. They're taking all the suburbs. They're taking the strategic heights, these terracons, the coal mines, everything around. And they're not going to storm Pokrovsk. They're just going to strangle it. And that's what's going, Ugledar. But they're effectively also, there's already street fighting in Solidova. They're putting Karahava into pincers already. They're prepping for an assault on Karahava that will be coming in the next probably few weeks. And then probably in another month or two until they're in a good enough situation where they'll start the real storming of Pokrovsk, but that's coming too. And there's no indication that the Kyiv regime, you know, slow Russia down at best. So that's a really bad situation for them. But that said, that's still artillery range from Donetsk City. There's a long, hard slog. And Russia is going to be forced to occupy large parts of Ukraine. They're not going to just give up. They're not going to sign any papers. If they did, you can wipe your butts with them, because that's all that they will be worth. Just like the February 21st agreement, the Minsk agreements, the Istanbul communique, nothing that you sign with this regime. You're going to have to root it out, root and branch, and it's going to have to be done city by city. And as things go, that will become easier at some point, because what defense they have will, you know, they won't have as much capability, but they're always going to fight as best as much as they can. And Russia has enough troops with volunteer contract soldiers. We're talking supposedly 800,000 in Ukraine by the end of the year. That is enough to take back the Donbass and probably Kherson and Zaporozhye. But if Russia is forced, and I believe they will be forced, to occupy the rest of Ukraine, they're going to need a lot more troops. It's not enough. Ukraine is a huge country. There will still be significant population centers. Russian military has not taken any population center bigger than Mariupol still. Right? Hasn't even tried to take Kharkov or Kherson City when, you know, they took it in the beginning when there was no fight and they just rolled in. But to take it back, to take Zaporozhye City, right, to take Dnipropetrovsk, Odessa, it's going to be a whole different ballgame. And Russia really doesn't want to destroy those cities. But I don't think they're going to be able to force them to some type of treaty where they just give up territory. I really don't. I don't think that the Kyiv regime is, or the West is ideologically capable of it. Maybe things will be different under Trump, but I don't think Russia is, the Russian government is quite clear. They don't believe that anything can change. They don't believe that the president of the United States really has the power to overrule the deep state, right? The blob, the permanent bureaucracy. And we saw during his first presidency that the deep state ran things and they called the shots and they manipulated him and they lied to him and they did whatever it took and it worked. He wanted to pull troops out of Syria and U.S. troops are still in Syria, right? They pulled the oil card, right? They manipulated. He wanted to pull troops out of Afghanistan and they prevented him from doing it at least until the next presidency. He wanted to have serious negotiations with North Korea, and they effectively wrecked that. So, can he change things again? I have my doubts, because he's still largely got to staff a government with, you know, political appointees who have to come from Republicans, right? And most Republicans are not Trumpists, right? You know, they're the John Bolton Pompeo types. There's not enough people in the Kinsey Institute to staff a government, unfortunately. There was a president who did try to change the deep state, you know, who did try to go up against it. You might remember his name. It's John F. Kennedy, right? And Trump has already survived two assassination attempts, possibly three, you know, depending on what you believe in the past few weeks. I actually don't think that's that helpful, because I think a J.D. Vance president might be even worse for them, at least on Ukraine. Although he's really hot for war with Iran and China. So, you know, maybe he could flip that out there. But anyway, Russia is winning. Everything is still trending positive, but there's still a long, hard, bloody slog, and I don't believe there's a political settlement anywhere in the near future, and the specter of some type of NATO direct intervention, it's not right now, but I think it's before the end of this conflict, still the most likely endgame.
Mark, we have more 20 minutes to talk about what's going on in the Middle East.
Boom!
It's new, and it's unbelievable what's going on and the way that they're trying to do this. And this is a new way of bombing. How did you find it?
For one, okay, so give them credit. Supposedly, the most recent reports, if these reports are true, and the Mossad puts out so much disinformation that, all right, let's assume that the story that these things were set off by micro explosives that were planted through a captured supply chain and everything are true, right? There is the possibility they're not, right? If Mossad is putting out information about something, you got to wonder whether it's true or whether it's intentional disinformation. But regardless, let's assume that's the story and that they've been working on this for 15 years. Okay, first of all, genius, right? Bond villain-esque genius, right? This is, of course, an act of mass terror. It is a terror attack. There were lots of civilians affected by this, because these pagers, of course, however much, you know, in the U.S., in the U.S. media, they might be trying to celebrate this as some type of the perfect targeted attacks, wiping out terrorists. First of all, let's not even get on the U.S. media, just propaganda that Hezbollah are terrorists or something like that. The U.S. is by far bigger terrorists, and certainly Israel, than Hezbollah is or has ever been. It's a coup. I mean, it's extremely effective. They took out some 3,000 people. I mean, how many of those people who suffered those injuries, a lot of them are going to be permanently maimed, damaged, and those who aren't are still going to be taken out of the fight for several months. There's a question. I think perhaps the most important question is, why did Israel do it now? Okay. So the story being repeated in the Western media, New York Times and elsewhere, is that suddenly Hezbollah was about to find out about it. And so Israel set it off. There's really no indication of that. I've seen no proof of that, and I don't expect to see any proof of that. The second is that this was deliberately done now to provide another provocation against Hezbollah to escalate this into a direct war with Hezbollah, which, as far as the Netanyahu government, will inevitably escalate to a direct conflict with Iran, which will hit the end target of it. And the end target of this terror attack is the United States, because they want to drag the United States and potentially the rest of the West into a conflict with Iran. It is Netanyahu's way to escalate out of a conflict against Hamas, which he can't destroy without ethnic cleansing the entire population of Gaza City. He has a political crisis. He has to keep escalating, because if the conflict ever ends, he'll be forced out of office almost immediately, and he doesn't want to give up power. So this is all part of another escalatory game, an escalatory provocation poke to get Hezbollah and Iran to give us the conflagration of the Middle East that Netanyahu has been trying and poking again and again. The strikes on the Iranian consulate, the assassination of Hezbollah commander Yusuf, the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh, the Hamas political leader and lead negotiator, right? All of this has been going for that reaction. And they've got to be frustrated, right? They got to have some blue balls, because Iran just hasn't given them what they wanted so far. And there's an indication, we've all been wondering that where was Iran's strikes in response to the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh? Nothing happened. We heard lots of stories about Russia bringing in S-400 air defense systems, bringing in Murmansk BN electronic warfare complexes, about bringing in perhaps Iskander ballistic missiles, whatever, and there's been, certainly Shoigu has been back and forth and back to forth with the Iranian government, and supposedly some new, tighter, more comprehensive strategic partnership between Russia and Iran is due to be signed in October. So maybe that explains part of it. But regardless, we have, in just the last 24 hours or so, it's emerged that there was an attempted assassination plot. I don't think the assassination actually started, but a plot to assassinate Netanyahu. And with an elder, older 70-year-old Israeli citizen who was supposedly going to help with it, blah, blah, blah. He came to Iran, so forth. We don't know whether this is true, but it makes some sense, right? Pezeshkian, if he doesn't want this all-out war, this conflagration, then a symmetrical response of trading an assassination for assassination makes perfect sense. The problem is, of course, is that Mossad has Iran penetrated with, operatives, with separatists in Baluchistan and Azerbaijan, with mercenaries, with terrorists, a lot more effectively than Iran has Israel penetrated, just by the nature of the two countries. So there's less, you know, opportunities for something like that, less capability. Supposedly they had this, and that might explain why there hasn't been any Iranian response yet. But, you know, after this blowing up of thousands of people, and it, again, it wasn't just Hezbollah militants, right? First of all, the majority of Hezbollah are actually bureaucrats. They're civil servants, right? Hezbollah is a popularly elected political party in Lebanon. They are effectively running all government services in South Lebanon, right? Which means, you know, the whole gambit. And these pagers were evidently also handed out to doctors, to medics, to EMTs, and everything. So that is why Russia has called this a monstrous act of terrorism. It's also, by the way, against international law, against international treaties that were brought up. Evidently, in World War II, there was evidently already lots of booby trapping of such things that was occurring by the Italians, by the Japanese, by the Allies, even. And there was international conventions put in place that such things, you can't booby trap things that are look like, normal civilian items. That's actually forbidden by international law. Not that Israel or the U.S. gives a shit, but technically Israel is a signatory to this, just like most other countries. So it's not only a mass act of terror, but it's also a war crime and a violation of international law. But, you know, if the U.S. is just fine with it, and apparently they are, in fact, it's rather interesting. They say, we saw nothing, we knew nothing, but you can't escape the fact that American University in Lebanon had a 10 days before this suddenly received an order to turn in and get replacements for all their pagers. Just saying. So, this would have made a lot more sense in they would have gotten much better military results from this if they did it once a large-scale conflict with Iran or with Hezbollah already broke out, right? If this happened in the middle of a conflict, that they would have gotten much better results from this. They would have created more chaos. They would have broken chains of command. All sorts of things, broken communications, but instead they tried to do it as a provocation, clearly because, and it, they did it not just with the pagers, but then also there was a second wave with walkie-talkies, possibly other electronic devices. We don't know the whole story there, but they immediately started heavy airstrikes. I mean, really heavy airstrikes on the border in Beirut. Not only has Nasrallah said that Lebanon is in a state of war, but the prime minister, non-Hezbollah prime minister of Lebanon has now said the same thing, that this was, you know, an act of war, that Lebanon is now at war. Evidently the Israeli plan is to seize probably everything south of Beirut at a minimum again, to create a buffer zone to push the Hezbollah rocket systems, multiple launch rocket systems, back. And that apparently, you know, Nasrallah's like, yep, that's what we want. Come and fight us here, because we don't have a military. Hezbollah is not a military force designed to invade Israel, right? They're designed to fight a guerrilla war in southern Lebanon, and Netanyahu seems willing to give it to them. We haven't heard a single word against any of this from the United States. Although every indication up till now has been that the U.S. did not want to get dragged into this conflict now. Not that they don't want a conflict with Iran, but they don't want it now, because they've already run out of artillery shells. They've already run out of air defense interceptor missiles, and a host of other military stuff. I just believe that they've got too much on their plate now, which is why they worked out that last pantomime attack with Iran. But right now, Biden appears to be on permanent senile old person vacation, and Blinken and Sullivan are running things, and maybe they've decided to go through with it. And I'll be straight up. On a purely cold-blooded geopolitical basis, I would be just fine with a Middle East conflagration. If the U.S. got involved in a war right now in the Middle East, right, against Hezbollah, against Iran directly, against the Houthis, and I for one, I don't know, I wouldn't want to go against the Houthis. They seem fucking unstoppable to me. All right, they're great, but if that started, and if I think a serious Middle East conflict, of course, is a lot less likely to result in a World War III scenario, because China and Russia certainly are not going to intervene directly, unless let's say somehow the Iranian government was going to fall. How is that going to happen? The U.S. is not going to invade Iran, right, with a million ground troops. It's going to be or even 500,000 or 300,000. It's just going to be a long-range strike war, you know, back and forth across the Middle East. And almost certainly the Iranian government, no matter how hard they're dealt a blow in this, and Russia has evidently, if we believe Western media, been trying to help Iranian build a defense with more air defense, more electronic warfare. But the Iranian government will survive. And as long as the Iranian government survives, then the U.S. wasting more resources, wasting more artillery shells, air defense interceptor missiles, JASSMs, political capital, funding, everything on a war in the Middle East will just seal a complete Russian victory in Ukraine. So, on that,
who's going to be the happiest country in the world if that happens?
Tell me, if there is a war that breaks out between the U.S. and Iran, what's going to happen to the price of oil?
Yeah, it's good.
Through the roof, right? Who benefits from a price of oil going through the roof? We do in Russia, right? So, I support Iran. I've long been a supporter of Iran. I've been a supporter of Hezbollah. But at this point, we are in a global war situation against U.S. hegemony. And this is inevitable at some point. I think that is exactly what the Russian government and the new Iranian government have been discussing for the past 6 or so weeks, that this is coming. Let's prepare for it. And the U.S. can barely deal with a proxy war against Russia, right? And Russia's winning. And they've run out of what they need to win this war. You want to throw a huge Middle East conflagration in that with Hezbollah and Iran and Yemen and perhaps Syria and Iraq, or at least parts of Syria and Iraq, right, as well. I don't know. I think they're crazy in the White House that they haven't done whatever they can to just say no. All they got to do to say Netanyahu is say no. No, they can't do it. They can't say no to Israel because the entire U.S. government is captured by IPAC. They just can't say no to Israel. It's politically impossible in the U.S. Read the book by Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt, right, on the lobby, the IPAC. But they can't do it. It's hard to say. I hate the usually saying the expression that the U.S. is dragged into a conflict. U.S. has never dragged into a conflict. They know right what they're walking into, but they're kind of like half-heartedly resisting at this point. Like, no, we don't really want to. Oh, come on, you know, BB, stop. Oh, okay, all right. You know, that's you know what it is. But it's, and China, right? If a war breaks out in the Middle East now, who's even going to be talking about a pivot to Asia, right? That puts back a U.S.-provoked war in the South China Sea and Taiwan Straits by another 5 years. That gives China another 5 years to chill, right? They'll be and build up their military. So China benefits from a conflict in the Middle East as well. Again, presuming that things don't quickly escalate into some type of World War III. But with Iran not having nuclear weapons, that becomes, you know, less likely of a scenario. So I don't know. They've done a seemingly impossible job between Iran and the United States. Iran showing restraint and the U.S. cutting deals to avoid this conflagration thus far. Maybe they can keep it up. I don't see how. But Hezbollah is getting pummeled right now. And it will be very hard for Iran. There is already reports that there is the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps is extremely upset that supposedly there was a meeting of all of this axis of resistance groups, the Houthis and Kataib Hezbollah and everything with the Iranian government. And they're like, why aren't you doing? Why aren't you responding? Why aren't you fighting? Maybe that's true. Maybe that's more Israeli disinformation. Who the hell knows? I don't know. Maybe some regional specialists, you know, would be able to talk more about the veracity of those reports. But we are closer to that big conflagration in the Middle East than we were the last time we talked. And maybe they'll find their way out of it again, but it is increasingly hard to see that path. I honestly didn't think the path existed last time. And they managed to find their way out of it. But there will likely be a conflagration. Ultimately, the Iranian government will survive, right? And it will just further exhaust the U.S., right? They'll do damage, right? They'll do incredible damage. The entire Middle East will be set on fire. But that will limit their capability to also deal with Russia and China. And you want to call it burden sharing among anti-hegemonic forces, right? Russia's been carrying the load for the last 2.5 years, a heavy load of that burden sharing. If Iran is forced into a situation where they have to pick up the part of it, again, it will only spread out the U.S. military capabilities and political capabilities further and further and further. And already the West, you know, if you listen to the U.S. State Department, the reason why a good part of the world is taking the Russian position or refusing to take the defense of Ukraine is because of RT, right? It has nothing to do with U.S. hypocrisy and you know, the evident and the rest of the world not wanting U.S. hegemony. It's all due to RT. But regardless, there is an acknowledgement that outside the English language bubble information sphere of the West, that Russia is winning the information war. And if the Middle East blows up and the West goes directly in defense of Israel, that will become even more so. So a multipolar world is not something that's just going to come into being without lots of blood and pain all over the world. It will be a very difficult birth, but and we'll be lucky to escape it without nuclear weapons or biological weapons or Terminator AI weapons or something being introduced. But, you know, it's what's has to happen and is going to happen one way or another. But if the U.S. can't pick its opponents one at a time, then it can't win. It doesn't have the resources to fight even two major conflicts now. It's barely holding on with one. So it will be bloody. It will be explosive. It will be terrible. But it will inevitably further hasten the end of U.S.-led Western global hegemony at the end of it, as long as we don't end all in a nuclear fireball. That's my positive. That's me being positive.
Thank you so much, Mark, for being with us today. Great pleasure to talk with you.
Thanks for having me.
Great pleasure.